Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Trump and trade. And Richard, this has been a topic that we've returned to a number of times over the course of the Trump administration, but it's taking on a new significance now because the trade negotiations with the Chinese have gone sideways, which has seen the U.S. raise tariffs on Chinese goods from 10% to 25%, and that's on about a third of the goods that we import from China. In response, China has said it's going to increase tariffs on about $60 billion worth of American goods. In response to that, President Trump is now threatening even more increases on the American side. So since we've covered some of the fundamentals here in previous podcasts, let me just start with a slightly different angle. There are some folks who share your general support of free trade, which you've mentioned in previous episodes, but are willing to give the president the benefit of the doubt here. And their argument is, look, this isn't Finland we're talking about. The Chinese don't really have anything like free trade. Their version of trade is predicated on the theft of intellectual property and by these massive strategic subsidies and by, some would argue, deliberately trying to weaken certain sectors of America's economy. They're, in other words, only using markets as sort of a means to a strategic end. In essence, this argument is there already was a trade war and they're the aggressors. What do you make of that? Is there a case for treating China differently than other trade partners?
Well, there's no question that they have to be treated differently because they're basically scoundrels through and through. But the usual rule when you're talking about defense, whether you're talking about trade, about military stuff, is you don't want it to be excessive and you want it to be proportionate. You don't want to go way out of boundaries. So what you have to do first is to figure out what it is that the Chinese do that is indefensible, and then see what kind of alliances you could bring to bear with respect to it. Well, the first thing that the Chinese do is they're absolutely scandalous with respect to the WTO, the World Trade Organization, rules. The most important one of these for these purposes is the rule which says that you cannot impose conditions on a country when it wishes to sell its goods inside your country. So the Chinese typically have a maneuver which says, well, you wish to sell X, Y, or Z or use technology A, B, and C in our country. What you have to do is to give us some information or some kind of advantage that our government can do. And many times what they want is actually trade secrets that are associated with the particular product in question. They get these trade secrets. There's no effort whatsoever to keep them confidential. They simply take them and turn them around to make their own production of their own goods much better, I think, than they would otherwise be. And, you know, what one has to really go after this. Now, the key point here is Trump does not have to be alone on this issue. The Chinese play this stunt with just about everybody. The WTO is not completely toothless, and even if it's not perfect, you get major trading partners to join into him. So instead of it being a one-man quixotic situation, it could now be a more coordinated affair. And I don't think, in effect, that he has taken that advantage. Second point that you mentioned is also correct. The Chinese are masters at intellectual property theft. And it's exactly the same kind of stuff that you have before. You bring some intellectual property over to China. What they will do is copy it, and then they will use that particular technology without paying you any kinds of royalties. And this is particularly easy to do with respect to patented goods, because in order to get your patent in the United States, you have to give a public declaration of the best mode of production, which essentially allows everybody else to figure how you make your thing. Trade secrets you keep secret, and secrecy is your protection. It's the law that gives you infringement remedies, so that for patents to work, they have to be made open and notorious, and it's therefore very easy to pilfer them if you're so inclined. And the Chinese are prepared to do that. Third feature that the Chinese are prepared to use is, even if they don't impose explicit tariffs, they're very much in favor of the, shall we say, the implicit discriminatory nature of the enforcement of the antitrust laws with respect to various kinds of goods and services sold in China. And what they do essentially is they apply very tough standards against American companies, forcing them to pay large fines or to change their marketing practices. And they're doing all of this to subsidize their own kinds of production. So anybody anybody who wants to call them scoundrels has my complete blessing. The hard question is to figure out what it is that you're supposed to do with this. And in my view, what you have to do is to maintain the high ground, and you don't want to start putting general tariffs on all sorts of other things unrelated to the particular subject of the dispute. You'd like to see at least first whether or not you could get some kind of alliances and concessions that isolate the trade problems associated with the abuses before you get to general tariffs and so forth. The problem about Trump on this issue is that even when he has a strong case, he is so willing to make stupid cases that you never know whether he's acting out of a sensible set of motives or a poor set of motives. So just to give you one other illustration, you know, when you start claiming that national security requires that all innovation in the automotive industry be done by American companies, and you call that a national security issue, everybody's just going to laugh at you. And so you have this president who's so erratic. He's irascible. He's very difficult. He's sometimes right, but he's often so wrong that he could never maintain focus. And since he cannot maintain his focus on the things that really matter, he fritters away whatever advantage he has in international trade circles.
Let me follow up with you on the national security point you just brought up, because the president, the context for our audience is the president said earlier this week that he was going to delay a decision on potential tariffs on automobiles for 6 months. But in so doing, he accepted the conclusion of a report from the Commerce Department that would classify these automobile imports as a national security threat. Now, the reason that that's important is that the president has basically unilateral power under statute to enact tariffs for national security purposes. Mm-hmm. This is also what he used for his tariffs on steel and aluminum. Richard, if we think about the flip side of this as well, when new trade agreements are passed, there's also this thing called fast track authority, where the president submits a trade deal to Congress and they can vote it up or down, but they can't amend it. So between those two trends, the president has a lot of discretion on trade relative to Congress. How healthy is that equilibrium?
Well, let's take this last thing first. If you don't have a fast track type of arrangement, you'll never get anything through. The basic logic behind it is if you just put this thing forward as a provisional agreement, and then in Congress, the one or another parties will say, well, you have to change this rule with respect to tobacco, that rule with respect to hardwoods and so forth, there'll be a million exceptions. The deal won't survive, and everybody else on the other side will walk away from you. And so you have to give the president upfront situation, and by bundling everything together, the vote is not can I get my special privilege. The vote is on average, do we think the American economy is going to be better with this package of goods than without it? And almost invariably, when you're talking about free trade, even though there are going to be a lot of uneven benefits and burdens, the overall number is likely to be plus, which means that the fast track authority will start to work. And so I'm pretty much in favor of doing that. And as ever, you have to be competent enough in the system that you'll do it with bad presidents as well as with good presidents. And Trump is not my ideal president when it comes to trade. But when it comes to the national security issue, I think the case is actually much more difficult. I remember many years ago sitting on one of these national security discussions with a bunch of serious scientists and physicists. And this is the kind of thing that you worry about. We are selling the Saudi Arabians an American bomber. And we have three systems that we could use for inertial guidance. Do we give them our best? Do we give them our second best? Do we give them our third best? And almost invariably what you start to say is we do not want to give them the stuff which contains our trade secrets at its maximum level because it's going to leak out from somewhere else. So what we'll do is we'll give them a slightly different package than the one that we make at home. We'll impose all sorts of covenants on the way in which these things do. We'll watch the way in which they're used in the field. We'll reserve the right to cancel further orders or new improvements if things go wrong. And these negotiations are incredibly difficult. Now, to come along and to say, in the face of that kind of national security arrangement, oh, it's a national security arrangement because what we're doing is we're buying Toyota cars made in America in many cases by a Japanese company, and that's a security risk. This is just bizarre. These guys have all sorts of patents in the United States. They contribute massively to the overall economy. Nothing that they have whatsoever would go through the kind of examination that you're talking about with respect to serious security goods. So the question then is, you mentioned that the president does have very broad powers with respect to national security. This has never been tested in the courts, but this would be a fine case in which to test it. I actually think you could win on the following argument. The president has to make at least a colorable case that national security is involved. You then go through the cases where it's admittedly involved, and then you start looking at this particular issue and ask yourself a preponderance test. Is this something which is just old, good old-fashioned protectionism, or is there any identifiable issue that you could raise? And one of the nice things about the Wall Street Journal editorial on this subject this morning, which was, as usual, a correct denunciation of Trump trade policies, is you to ask him, what's the national security interest here? If anything, it cuts in exactly the opposite direction. You want to have strong national security. You want to have a very close collaborative arrangement with your strong and dependable allies so that you could get their information and they can get yours so that both of you could beef up your defense capabilities. So unless you think that the Japanese to some extent are in league with the Chinese or the Russians, they're the perfect trading partner. In fact, we would like them to be perhaps a little bit more militarily sufficient than they've been at present. So this thing is just completely wacky. It's upside down and backwards. And when something is that bad, it may well be that somebody could puncture the president's authority on this particular issue. So I do not think it's going to go this way. Let me just give one kind of straw in the wind on this. We now have on the Supreme Court Kavanaugh and Gorsuch. It's quite clear that there are very profound differences between the two men, but it's also clear both of them are in a position where they generally believe that unparalleled and unquestioned deference to administrative decisions by the president or by any administrative agency are things to be deeply questioned. And so they're going to bring a higher level of scrutiny, and I think that that's likely to radiate. And what's intriguing about this is if it actually went up to the Supreme Court or even to a bunch of Republican judges in, say, the Seventh Circuit or one of the other places where they sit in abundance, these guys are going to start to think, this is not the kind of deference that we believe in. If it turns out that we think that administrative agencies have to be chained a little bit, then so too the president. And we're going to really clobber him on this one because we don't think that he can make a colorable case for what he's doing. So I do not think, in effect, that he is secure on this particular front, as might have been the case if you looked at the judiciary, particularly on the deference issue, the way it sat 3 or 4 years ago.
Richard, this is what the president tweeted about the increased tariffs on China a few days ago. Tariffs will bring in far more, that's all caps, far more wealth to our country than even a phenomenal deal of the traditional kind. Tariffs will make our country much stronger, not weaker. How do you react to that?
I mean, the man is a complete fool when it comes to making statements like this. If you don't have the tariffs, you get gains from trade. If, in fact, you do have the tariffs, then all those gains are going to be law, and you're going to have to buy everything himself. The president's basic vision is, if you're a farmer and we just cut you off from all these external supplies, well, by God, you'll be terrific. You'll make your own plows. You'll make your own seed. You'll make your own everything, and you'll be stronger for it. This is not true. It's nonsense. And the problem about the president is he works under this deep set of delusions that tariffs, in effect, are an end in themselves. If he were right about this, and if he actually believed he was right about this, then he wouldn't bother to negotiate with the Chinese. You just put the tariffs up right now and say, hey, we're stronger for what's going on. But what happens? If you start looking at the president, at the same time he starts cheering on the tariffs, he's now trying to figure out how it is he's going to have a transfer payment to help farmers who have lost their foreign markets and may not be able to regain them if it turns out that the Brazilians or the Argentinians or the Chileans or somebody else, the Australians, now start selling goods in large quantities to China and become dependable and regular suppliers. Well, why are you giving them this aid? Because they're actually hurting under these circumstances. Now, when you give them the aid, this does not solve the problem. It just transfers it to another sector. You've got to either increase deficits, which means you cannot borrow for useful product, or you have to raise taxes, which means in effect that you're going to reduce the gains from voluntary transaction. So this stuff doesn't just disappear because it's a transfer payment. All he's saying is, I'm going to have the farmers get some of the pain, and then I'm going to try to spread the rest of it around, and I'm going to throw administrative costs on everything. His position is so transparently threadbare that you just simply sit and sigh, because he knows so little about what he's talking on these particular issues that it's just exasperation squared to listen to him trot out these arguments. The only thing he should do right now is get rid of somebody like Wilbur Ross, who runs the Commerce Department, who's the same kind of narrow-thinking guy that the president turns out to be. So I think, in effect, if these attitudes continue, there's a disaster. Many people say about Trump, he's crazy like a loon. He's doing all this to throw everybody else off balance. He doesn't believe anything he says, and that what he's going to do is going to get a somewhat better trade deal. But this is the answer I would give to that. If we had a good trade deal, not the perfect trade deal, but a good trade deal within 2 months or 3 months after Trump get into office, the gains from that would be so great that nothing he can do to pull a coup off 3 years after this thing starts is going to give you a tenth of what you could have gotten if you had a sensible trade deal. And so what you want to do is to keep the trade flowing in both directions with respect to commodities and so forth, and then get tough on the issues that I mentioned: intellectual trade property theft, conditional grants, patent appropriation, misapplication of the antitrust laws. Go after them where you could get allies. Don't go after them on these things and then cloud it in a set of rhetoric that make you sound as though you know nothing whatsoever about the subject. Because the more he tweets like this, the less confidence anybody who knows anything about this issue is going to have in him or his judgments.
So, final question. I do this just to vex you.
Oh, good enough.
I give you two choices. One is the America of May 2019. Donald Trump's tax cuts have passed. He's deregulating big swaths of the economy, but he's doing things that you, Richard Epstein, regard as crazy on trade. Or I give you an alternate universe in which a generic, somewhat timid, unadventurous Republican president has left the status quo on taxes and regulation pretty much where they are, but has avoided all this trade disruption with the Chinese tariffs and NAFTA renegotiation, and maybe has even signed on to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, expands our trade presence worldwide. Which of those worlds would you rather be living in?
I think I would probably take the crazy Trump world. And the explanation is relatively simple. I think the volume of domestic trade is still vastly larger than the volume of international trade. And I do think the trade liberalization at home has been better. But each time he does something stupid, the gap becomes a little bit narrower. And as you throw in the TPP, that's another situation. Let me give you a kind of quantitative estimate and then one other observation. If you ask me what I think the entire Trump package of taxation and deregulation has done, put that at plus five. And then you ask yourself, what do I think has happened with respect to what's going on with the trade? I put it at minus one and minus two. So the guy's a plus three. And then you take these other guys. I mean, it may well be that what they are is they're a plus one on trade and a plus one on everything else, and they're still behind them. And if you want the more explicit comparison, what are you going to say about the Democrats? Well, remember, they opposed TPP too because they knew it would not help Hillary Clinton get elected. They also frustrate all sorts of free trade agreements by having environmental and union caveats which don't belong in these kinds of arrangements. On the domestic economy, they basically are trying to make the United States look a little bit more like California, the way Illinois is going, the way New Jersey is going, the way Connecticut is going, the way New York is going in different degrees. This would be a disaster. So if you want me to kind of give an estimate, Trump gets reelected. It seems to me that the stock market pretty much stays where it is, goes up a little. If he was sensible on trade, it'd go up 4,000 or 5,000 points. Democrats come in, I think the thing starts to go down by 25, 30% within a week or two, particularly if it's any one of the leading candidates, none of whom what's going on. The only possible unknown is Biden, and I don't think of him as a sterling intellect or as a deep thinker. He's just, shall we say, he's got a little bit more native smarts in the sense that he's not taken in by all of this rhetoric, but I don't think he has a clear vision of the way things work. But if you were to elect Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris, you're looking at the Dow going down to 17,000 from 25,000. So I think that's the situation that we start to have. And so the president, having done many right things, probably for the wrong reasons, becomes the strange, weird, composite defender of the free market system. So he gets a kind of an A-minus on domestic issues. I don't think he gets quite an A. And he sort of gets a D or a D-plus on foreign trade. The plus comes from the fact that just as he's about to impale the entire nation on one of his free trade or trade war swords, he backs off like he did when he pulled some of the tariffs off the other day from both Canada and Mexico in order to make it easier to get some revision on NAFTA. So, I mean, he plays brinkmanship all the time. I don't think he realizes how dangerous a game that he's playing. But better that he play his crazy game and then some Democrat come along and simply do everything wrong as a matter of high principle.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at Hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit Hoover.org.